package programming as journalism or public affairs, but what it really is unidirectional messaging for their political purposes built around advertising and marketing principles.
Welcome to the Washing Tech Policy Podcast.
The latest tech law and policy news and brightest tech law and policy experts wherever you are.
So you can stay informed, on the move, in less time.
From Washington, D.C., it's the Washing Tech Policy Podcast.
With Joe Miller.
George Soros and Hillary Clinton say Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg are intentionally swaying the 2020 election in favor of Donald Trump. Here in the Beltway, D.C. officials in Georgetown are developing a new algorithm to ramp up housing inspections, and Ann Nelson is my guest. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and billionaire Democratic megadonor George Soros called out Facebook's apparent intention to get President Trump reelected. The social media platform continues to maintain its policy of allowing ads placed by politicians that contain falsehoods to remain on the platform. According to Bloomberg, in a speech at the World Economic Summit in Davos, Mr. Soros stated, quote, "I think there is a kind of informal mutual assistance operation or agreement developing between Trump and Facebook," end quote. He went on to say that Facebook and Trump will work to protect each other. At the Sundance Film Festival and in an Atlantic interview, Ms. Clinton expressed similar concerns and said that Zuckerberg's philosophy of letting his users decide for themselves what's true or false is an authoritarian perspective. According to new reports in The Guardian, Amazon founder and CEO Jeff Bezos' smartphone was hacked in 2018. Forensic investigators reportedly found a high probability that a malicious file that was embedded within a WhatsApp conversation between Mr. Bezos and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman scoured Bezos' phone for personal information. The Hill notes that 9 months later, the National Enquirer revealed the details of Mr. Bezos' extramarital affair, although both Saudi Arabia and National Enquirer former parent company American Media Inc. both deny Saudi Arabia's involvement. 2018 was also the year that Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi was murdered, a murder the U.S. concluded was ordered by bin Salman, an allegation that bin Salman and the Saudi government deny. President Trump, though, has backed bin Salman and the Saudi government's denials of the murder. In addition to controlling Amazon, Mr. Bezos also owns the Washington Post, so multiple lawmakers and cybersecurity experts believe the alleged attack, reportedly conducted with tools linked to a bin Salman associate, was designed to suppress reporting on Mr. Khashoggi's murder. On Wednesday, Bezos tweeted a photo of himself standing with Mr. Khashoggi's fiance under the hashtag Jamal. Hackers gained access to several NFL teams' social media profiles on Monday, including those of the San Francisco 49ers and the Kansas City Chiefs, who are set to face off in Super Bowl 54 next Sunday. The hackers got into the team's Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram accounts. The hackers removed profile pictures, bios, and headers. Other teams affected included the Dallas Cowboys, Philadelphia Eagles, the Houston Texans, New York Giants, Chicago Bears, and the NFL's own official Twitter account. Rodney Scott, the 27-year Customs and Border Patrol veteran whom President Trump tapped to lead the agency, has reportedly been a member of the same Facebook group that led to his predecessor's firing. The Facebook group I'm 1015, 1015 is the code name CBP officers use to communicate when they have a so-called alien in custody, has been the site of racist and misogynistic attacks against Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in addition to other racist and sexist posts. Former CBP Chief Carla Provost retired after it was discovered that she was a member of the group. Finally, the Washington Post reports Georgetown University and the D.C. Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs are working on a new algorithm to go after slumlords in the District of Columbia. The Washington Post had reported back in 2017 that Sanford Capital, which owns several buildings in the district, maintained poor conditions, including broken doors, rat infestations, and problems with heat and sewage, even as they received millions in taxpayer subsidies. The new algorithm will be designed by Georgetown students and with the goal of improving efficiencies in an understaffed and unwieldy building inspection system. And you can find links to all of these stories in the show notes. Stay with us.
The inclusive voice of tech policy. Watching Tech. We see you.
My guest today is Ann Nelson. Ann is a native of Oklahoma, a graduate of Yale University, and an award-winning journalist. She's also the author of multiple books, The Shadow Network being her most recent. She has taught at Columbia University for more than two decades, first in the School of Journalism and more recently in the School of International and Public Affairs. Anne will shed light on how the Council of National Policy, which was created in 1981, has worked for four decades to channel money and resources to influence the outcome of our elections and public policy. The book has been praised by a number of individuals, including Nancy MacLean, who is the author of Democracy in Chains. Please welcome Ann Nelson. Ann, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Joe.
So first off, I loved your book.
Thank you. It was a major effort, I could say.
So what prompted you to write it? What was the moment when you realized this was the book you needed to write? Or maybe there were several moments.
Yes, there actually were. One was some years ago when I was visiting family in Oklahoma, and I happened to tune the radio in the car on to a local station, and I could see that it was both religious and very virulently political. And in terms of its, you know, the tax-exempt status of churches, this really puzzled me, and I kind of filed that away. And then the second moment was the 2016 elections. And like everybody else I knew, I'd been following the major media and the predictions and the polls and so on. And there was a great big gap between what we were told and what the outcome was. So I started putting those two ideas together. What was going on in the swing states and the middle of the country that people on the coasts were just not cottoning onto? And that really led me to writing Shadow Network.
So the Council for National Policy is the foundation of your book, and then you built from there. What is the CNP, and what kinds of principles and ideology are they focused on?
Well, the CNP is an umbrella organization. So I don't argue that it's active in its own right. It's relatively small, relatively modestly funded, but it coordinates a large number of organizations which cumulatively move millions of dollars around. And what I found was that as a coordinating body, it could organize the money from donors like the DeVos family in Michigan and some of the oil barons of Texas and Louisiana, and use that to support what they call grassroots organizations, which are basically politically active groups that then also coordinate with their broadcasters. They're heavily involved in radio, also very present in what is called Christian television broadcasting. And so all of this put together creates a kind of well-oiled machine that can be applied to swing states and critical districts to get out the vote for the radical right of the Republican Party, and in many instances also suppress the votes of the opposition. And I argue that it's been surprisingly effective over the years.
You noted in the book that it has its foundation, the Calvinist movement?
Well, it really does go back to fundamentalist organizations in the Southwest, particularly Texas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma, which is my home state. So the Southern Baptist Convention is very present, and it was part of the roots of this organization. And the Southern Baptists are a Calvinist denomination like some others. So there are these ideas that you see permeating the movement that argue that they have a direct line to God, that God tells them to instruct the rest of us what to do, that prosperity is something that God gives you, and that if you're poor, it's because God wants you to be. So that kind of wipes out social programs and efforts to relieve poverty. If that's what God wants, hey, let it roll. And on the contrary, if God wants you to be extremely wealthy, then who's to argue with that? So it's really, I would say, they have interpreted Calvinism in their own way to make it very anti-democratic and also socially very regressive.
So tell us about CNP's media empire.
Well, it was founded in 1981, building on the success of the Reagan campaign. And from the beginning, it included major donors and it included political operatives coming out of the Goldwater campaign. And very early on, they brought in the media component. It started with fundamentalist radio, some of them in the South, some of them in Southern California. So you've got three large and very active radio networks, one of them based in Tupelo, Mississippi. Then there's Bot Radio in the Midwest, and then the giant, which is Salem Media, which is based in Southern California. And the founders and owners of all three of these radio networks have been members, leading members of the Council for National Policy. But then you've got the Religious Broadcasters Association, which is heavily fundamentalist and Southern Baptist, and they've been very active with it. Then you have Salem really increasing its reach across platforms in recent years. So they acquired a book publishing company, Regnery. They're involved in many online platforms, so they repurpose their content, and they will kind of package programming as journalism or public affairs, but what it really is unidirectional messaging for their political purposes built around advertising and marketing principles. So people are pretty much told flat out that it is virtuous and Christian to vote for a Republican, and it is sinful to vote for a Democrat who they may describe as literally a demon on some of these programs. So networked, this operation is extremely powerful. It even extends to feature films, which open wide across the country. I saw one of them, which was a film attacking Planned Parenthood, and I saw it on Times Square in New York City.
And I just wanted everyone to keep in mind that, you know, the growth of CNP's media empire happened basically in conjunction with the repeal of things like the Fairness Doctrine and the tax certificate, which offered tax incentives for selling stations to women and people of color, and the 1996 Act, which led to deregulation and consolidation. A perfect example is of consolidation that directly impacted programming was MS Broadcasting's acquisition of both Hot 97 and 98.7 Kiss FM in New York City in the 90s. And, you know, Emmis isn't thought of as a CNP-affiliated broadcast group. But Kiss was Hot 97's primary competitor and was playing hip-hop years before Hot 97. But Emmis very slowly dismantled Kiss FM after they acquired it, probably so it wouldn't be too obvious what they were doing. But they very slowly wound it down, gave up the call letters to another station owner in Jackson, Mississippi, ensuring Kiss would never return to New York. And now they lease the frequency to Disney. So there's this one last heritage music station serving New York and serving African Americans in New York specifically, called WBLS. And Emmis operates that station too. And we've now got a Republican controlled FCC, which repealed net neutrality and has tried and failed, thankfully, to relax the media ownership rules.
Yeah, and my fear is that when you have this galloping concentration of ownership in the mass media, it really can contribute to authoritarian forms of government, because people have broadcast less diverse information, fewer local viewpoints, and this is combined with the collapse of local newspapers across the middle of America. So in a lot of ways, Americans are getting more random information through digital media, but it's not curated, it's not verified, and it's got a lot of issues with it, and they're getting less professional journalism in their lives.
We're going to stop down here, but when we come back, we'll learn more about how this conservative media ownership landscape has shaped American politics and what the implications are as we head into the 2020 presidential election. Stay with us. Thank you. fast forward to the aughts. Why did this media empire fail to prevent Barack Obama's election and re-election, and how did it help get Trump elected?
Yeah, so I've taught digital communications courses at Columbia for a number of years. And what we saw was that Obama's team in 2008 really got out ahead in terms of digital campaign tools. And they used analytics in a new way. They connected those to phone banks. There were all kinds of innovations that helped him out a lot. And the Republicans were stunned. What happened was in 2010, the Koch brothers woke up to the fact that Obama was really implementing a lot of environmental policies that they felt would cut into their oil profits. So they made a big investment. They invested $50 million in a new data platform called I360 in 2010. And that started giving them an edge, especially in local races and swing states. And that was woven into a set of mobile apps that were developed for partners in the Council for National Policy. So by 2016, the combination of the data and the apps and the canvassing organizations really gave them some strength in swing states. And the result of all of these efforts was that Hillary Clinton won the popular election by 3 million votes, and Trump won the Electoral College by fewer than 100,000 in only three swing states. So I spend some time in my book, Shadow Network, shining a light on how these mechanics worked. And the real key was not that the Republicans' data was better than the Democrats. I don't think it has been. But I do believe it was better networked and shared across state-level campaigns and integrated into canvassing organizations.
So looking to 2020, would you say this mechanism, this machine is weaker, stronger, or about the same?
I think that you've got a real contest. You know, it's like one of those movies, you know, Godzilla movies, because both sides realize that 2020 is a moment of truth. The demographics favor the Democrats. The population is ever younger, more diverse, more secular, but the Republicans and the radical right wing of the Republican Party is going for broke. And one of the things they've been doing very aggressively is moving along appointments to the federal courts. They've been steamrolling these things through the Senate at a record speed. And that means that when they get these judges appointed at the various levels of the federal court, they can determine policies on gerrymandering, voter suppression, and many other aspects of our electoral system. And so if they have not just the next few months, but the next 4 years, they could really remake the legal framework of this country. So I would say in Oklahoma terms that both sides are going hell for leather.
Well, thanks, Sam, for joining me. And really, for your book, I think if more people took the time to read it, then perhaps going forward, we won't have such enormous ideological gaps between the people who own most of our media and the people who don't. It's really become almost like an electoral college in the sense that its output doesn't really reflect popular opinion. What are some closing ideas you'd like to leave with us, and where can we find you online?
I've been regularly updating the research from my book, Shadow Network, on Twitter, and I think there's a growing community of people who are concerned about these issues who are in this conversation. So my Twitter name is A. Nelsona, A-N-E-L-S-O-N-A. And if people want to learn more, that's a great place to do it. In closing, I just think that people should really focus on how our electoral system actually works. Because moving forward into 2020, all the indications are that even if the Democrats win as many as, you know, a margin of as many as 5 million votes in the popular election, the Electoral College will still determine the outcome. And it still appears that that race will be extremely close in six critical swing states, some of them from the 2016 election, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, the Southern Path of North Carolina, Florida, and Arizona. So much of the discussion and the debate about which candidate is more perfect and so on and so forth is focused on the idea of national polls and the early primary states. And the harsh truth is that they will, in the end game, be of very little relevance. And I think that the other issue that is very prominent is that the control of the Senate will have a massive impact on our country moving forward. And again, but people on the coast don't like to realize how much influence lies in the middle of the country and how bad the connections of communication are between the coasts and the middle of the country. So we've got a lot of bridge building to do. We have to see what happens in November 2020. In terms of environmental policy, this election couldn't be more critical. I think that the future of the planet depends on it. So I hope that people really focus on how the mechanics of our elections function and attend to it.
The future of the planet depends on it. That is a strong, strong statement and one that I hope resonates with everybody. You've been listening to Ann Nelson, author of The Shadow Network and faculty advisor for Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs New Media Network. Ann, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Joe.
That concludes episode 217 of the podcast. Thanks for listening. If you like what we do, we'd love to hear from you. Please take a moment, head over to Apple Podcasts, give it a review. It helps others know what they can expect from the show and helps us out tremendously. Also, mark your calendars now. On March 25th, we're hosting our first annual conference in partnership with NYU's Center for Critical Race and Digital Studies. Registration information is available on our website at www.washingtech.com. Hope to see you there. And thanks again for listening. I'll see you back here next week. Take care.
Washing Tech.